Welcome to the Information Security Forum podcast. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert, and today we're bringing you the first in a series of episodes focusing on human-centered security. ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin, as always, is in the studio with me today. And we're going to discuss in this episode how to manage insider threat. Steve, we know that as people have become increasingly mobile and hyperconnected, the insider threat has intensified. Almost every worker has multiple devices that can compromise information instantly and at scale. Impact is no longer limited by the amount of paper someone is carrying. Simultaneously, social norms are shifting, which is eroding loyalty between employers and employees. A job for life is being replaced by a portfolio of careers. In fact, Experian's data breach industry forecast finds that between human error and malicious insiders, time has shown us the majority of data breaches originate inside company walls. Employees and negligence are the leading causes of security incidents, but remain the least reported issue. The explosion of digital devices creates real challenges for organizations of all sizes. The majority consider themselves vulnerable to insider threats, and most include insider threats in their top three security concerns. So, Steve, let's start by getting clear. What does the insider threat look like? Whatever the threat tactic, the thing most insider threats have in common is that they're usually initiated by malicious actors, right?
Well, I can understand why you'd think so, Tavia, but no. I mean, in fact, whilst most research on the insider threat focuses on malicious behavior, the threat is actually considerably broader than that. So insider negligence and insider accidents comprise a greater and growing proportion of information security incidents. So CISOs who limit their thinking just to malicious insiders are seriously miscalculating the risk. Let's look then at three areas of insider threat to explain that in a little bit more detail. The first is perhaps the most obvious, the one that gets most of the attention, the energy and the resource in the majority of organizations. Person M decides to leave the organization and, before giving notice, starts copying sensitive information to a personal drive, leaking confidential information, sabotaging networks, even using work privileges for personal benefit. Now, that's obvious. That's obviously an example of malicious behavior. There's a motive to harm, plus a conscious decision to act inappropriately. In another scenario, one that's still relatively easy to quantify, person N must work remotely to meet an important deadline, so upload sensitive information to a free cloud service that is later breached. This is undeniably negligent behavior. But there's no motive to harm. There is a conscious decision to act inappropriately. Acts like these are usually well-intentioned. I think that's the important thing to remember, right? Such as when, you know, protocols are breached to save time, for instance. That's the usual one. Increased productivity is another very common one. Or indeed, enable mobile working. And the behavior often comes with the full knowledge that the action is bypassing a control or circumventing a policy. So despite the lack of malicious intent, negligent insiders are knowingly accepting risk that is outside the organization's risk appetite. But what about the case of person A, who is repeatedly interrupted at the end of a stressful and exhausting week and in haste sends an email containing sensitive information to the wrong recipient? And that's a very real problem, because a lot of email systems today, of course, have autocomplete. So unless you're really going to check before you press the send button, you could easily fall victim to that. Now, the truth is, not enough organizations are actually looking into that type of insider threat. It's under the radar for far too many leaders. In people like person A, the problem is an accidental behavior. There's no motive to harm, no conscious decision to act inappropriately. Emailing information to the wrong people, opening malicious attachments and publishing private data on public servers can all happen accidentally. But let's go quickly back over these three examples of insider threat: malicious, negligent, accidental. In all three examples, the person had access to sensitive information because of the privileges granted by the organization. Sensitive information was compromised when it inappropriately left the organization. The organization was exposed to risk. The organization trusted the person to protect the information, and the person did not protect the information, or in other words, did not uphold the trust placed in them by the organization.
So what I can extrapolate is that regardless of whether these insider acts are malicious, negligent, or accidental, the impact on the organization is going to be similar.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So regardless of the origin of the insider threat, as you've just said, the impact is similar. But the key takeaway for listeners is that the impact the insider threat can have is going to be problematic, but the likelihood of insider threat can vary considerably. Hmm. So to understand the risk posed by insiders, organisations must understand not only the impact, but also the likelihood of insider threats being realised. So in other words, the impact and likelihood of trust not being upheld. Hmm. Now that depends on the complexity of people, their motives, loyalties, ideologies, relationships with the organisation. But there is good news, or at least empowering news. More than half of the incidents in our research were reported to be insider threat, and most of those were deemed to be accidental rather than malicious. That means that organisations can do much more to minimise the likelihood of insider threat having an impact and then make real progress in increased security.
Hmm. So if that's true, where would we begin? We want to increase security and we want to address insider threat, especially accidental insider threat. What would be the first step?
Well, I think first thing we need to do is really assess the insider risk. And there are a number of ISF tools that can support that kind of assessment, such as threat profiling, for instance, providing a common threat list that is used to produce a prioritised threat landscape. Or CISOs might look at a risk factor called likelihood of initiation or the likelihood that insiders will not uphold the trust placed in them. So in this case, an information risk practitioner would be advised to consult much more widely when assessing trustworthiness, asking specialists such as human resources teams, psychologists perhaps, other social scientists, what psychometric or other assessments could help determine threat attributes. Such assessments can really help determine the likelihood that an insider will behave inappropriately.
Hmm. So once that risk has then been thoroughly assessed, where would we go next?
Well, once we've done that, we can then move on to apply technical controls and, I think more importantly, perhaps management controls. Now, what's interesting is that our research revealed that even though there is an abundance of guidance on effective technical controls, not all organisations have implemented the basic first steps, including things like identity and access management solutions, desktop solutions that enforce data classification, for example, by encrypting confidential documents before email. Or by preventing highly confidential documents being emailed to external addresses, data loss prevention, event logging and monitoring, or remote wiping of mobile devices. Technical controls like these should be supplemented by management controls, such as reconciliation, segregation of duties, reviews, audits, and so on. Behavioural analytics and monitoring tools can also help develop a baseline of normal behaviour, so abnormal behaviour can be detected. But only about 20% of firms that we talk to continuously monitor user behaviour and proactively identify threats in this way. Now, it's true, of course, that legal considerations have to be taken into account when monitoring workers. And certainly that varies depending on where you happen to be. So if you're in the European Union, it's very, very different from those listeners, for instance, that might be in the United States listening into this podcast. Many jurisdictions put limits on how intrusive monitoring can be, especially if people are singled out for monitoring before being accused of wrongdoing. But it really must be done if you want to appropriately and thoroughly move towards true security. Some potential controls include when an enterprise is attracting and recruiting. So security leaders should conduct pre-employment screening, vetting and security clearances, include relevant clauses in employment contracts, and perform integrity checking of suppliers, contractors and other third parties. When new employees are inducted into the organisation, good practice says you should ensure that they're equipped with the knowledge and the skills to behave as secure insiders. So you need to be linking expected information security behaviour to the overall norms and values of the organisation. Next, as always, security leaders must evaluate the cyber hygiene of their employees, including security and trust evaluations in supervision, performance management, appraisals, and making sure that disciplinary policies contain clear and fair consequences for malicious, negligent, and even accidental insider behaviour. CISOs should develop an anonymous reporting capability that workers can use if they observe behaviours that concern them and technical controls they might miss. And then when somebody leaves your employment, so on the exit of an employee, leaders should revoke all physical and digital access credentials. If the insider was highly privileged, then you need to consider what could be done to verify that information hasn't been compromised.
Okay, so one security leader has addressed their insider risk and they have applied better controls. What would they need to do after that next step?
Well, the next step then is to align roles, responsibilities and privileges. So I probably need to explain that a little bit. When insiders have access to information they don't need, there is a mismatch between roles, responsibilities and privileges. And that then creates opportunities for insiders to abuse their privileges and compromise information. Insider privileges vary. It could be basic email, network access, right the way up to highly restricted access given to subject matter experts and system administrators, for instance. Mm-hmm. The greater the access, the greater the impact if trust is not upheld. So insiders with more privilege may require greater security. Privileges should be reassessed regularly, and unnecessary privileges revoked when roles and responsibilities change. So when an insider departs, for instance, the organisation should disable all access, including non-core systems, such as client systems and social media. There are many examples of data being compromised by people who still had access even after they'd left their organisations because that hadn't been a process that was followed. In fact, Carnegie Mellon recently found that 70% of insiders who stole intellectual property from an employer did so within 60 days of their termination from the organisation.
It's a long span of time after
it is.
An exit.
Yeah, 2 months. So organisations may consider revoking or even reducing access before people actually leave. However, they really need to consider whether doing so undermines the culture of trust. And it's this fine balance when we start talking about insiders. You want to do enough, but not so much that you destroy the trust paradigm that you've built with your people.
Creating a problem.
Creating a problem, exactly. Right. And it's useful to consider at each stage of the employment life cycle what trust the organisation is placing in people and what can be done to reduce risk and improve that trustworthiness.
You know, a lot of this seems like it's very obvious and very basic, but your own research is saying that organizations are not doing even these very basic things. So I think that this is useful to remind ourselves to do the basics and then move up from there, be thorough and consistent. Is there anything else that we need to think about or shift within our enterprise?
I think so. I think there's one other thing that I'd mentioned, Tavia, and that's you do need to expand. I think most organizations need to do this. Just expand out the insider threat program. Such programs range from, you know, relatively straightforward things with basic steps such as prevent, detect, respond, right the way across to Carnegie Mellon's 13-point pattern-based approach, which came out of research from, I think it was over 700 insider threat cases that they looked at. But regardless of the threat program you select, organizations need to develop and run insider threat programs that ensure that the themes we've been discussing are really put in place and mitigated where appropriate. If they're not already addressing them, then the insider threat program should be expanded to ensure that all three risky insider behaviors, that's malicious, negligent, and accidental, are addressed. Insider risk really needs to be managed as well, I'd say, at all stages of the employee life cycle. And the organization knows when it places trust in its insiders that it really is, I think, opening the door to access into a whole range of very sensitive information. But the key to it is really to focus on how you can improve the processes, the policies, the ways in which you engage with the employee, and therefore improve trustworthiness.
So with those steps in place, are we then in a healthier, more sustainable position with great cyber hygiene?
We're certainly in a better place, but even that isn't fully sufficient. The most powerful thing an organization can do is foster this culture of trust, one where the organization can trust its people, its insiders, and most importantly, perhaps, where insiders can trust the organization in return. So it's a two-way street. And this is perhaps the most challenging and the most intuitive task. But it invites talented and forward-thinking leaders to be really innovative and authentic and to show really true leadership skill, because fostering a culture of trust isn't something that you can do overnight. It doesn't come out of a box, and it certainly isn't a 10-step program. This invites organizations to deeply consider things like their value systems, their mission, the way they communicate, at really every level of the organization. The trust organizations are placing in insiders has grown as well with advances in information technology, increasing risk and changing work environments. This trend, of course, is bound to continue as the volume of information insiders can access, store and transmit continues to soar. And mobile working, for very many people, becomes the status quo. Cultures of trust will be a greater focus of the ISF as we head into 2020. It's certainly something that I'm passionate about. So that's a topic we'll be coming back to, I'm sure, and certainly I hope so. But let's come back next time for a series of conversations about the importance of human-centered security how to identify vulnerabilities in human beings, how those vulnerabilities are exploited, and finally, how they can be managed. That overview will immediately bring greater clarity to security leaders and help mitigate the insider threat across each of the different areas that we've just been talking about. And then we can move on to building deeper cultures of trust.
Interesting. This has been a really revealing discussion, Steve, and I appreciate you walking us through again what on paper seems pretty basic and pretty obvious, but I think we cannot reinforce these ideas often enough. It's clear that security leaders must recognize the fact that technical and management controls have limitations, and that the greatest weakness in an organization, potentially human beings, can be transformed into an organizational strength. I think what you're saying is that it can't be a choice, that organizations must trust their insiders to protect the information they handle. So they will always face some risk of that trust not being upheld. But the answer is to create, cultivate, and embrace a deeper understanding of trust. Organizations must understand where and how they are trusting their insiders and must augment technical and management controls by helping people to become more worthy of the trust placed in them. Equally, organizations should foster a culture that makes the organization worthy of trust in return. I know that you're passionate about human behavior and human psychology, so I look forward to hearing more about how leaders can develop trusting cultures that support the goals and needs of everyone within the organization, from the board to the employees. We'll be back with some of those conversations soon. In the meantime, listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review it. And we'd love it if you'd share it in your networks. Be sure to visit securityforum.org to join the conversation on our LinkedIn group, access the show notes, and download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance relating to this discussion. We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening.